Welcome to the Northbound Wealth Podcast. All opinions expressed by me, my co-hosts, or my guests are solely our own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Northbound Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and is not intended as personalized recommendations or fiduciary advice. It is not intended to provide and should not be relied upon for any investment, accounting, legal, and tax advice or as a solicitation to offer or buy any securities. Clients of Northbound Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. Hello, everyone. This is Brent Foster, your host of the Northbound Wealth Podcast. Today is March 4th. Let's dive in. So stocks extend their tech-led advance last week as signs of a resilient and still enthusiastic consumer-boosted momentum. The NASDAQ sets new highs. Finally, we're there. So all major indices have done it. Stocks traded in a narrow band early in the week, but ended the five trading sessions with a powerful advance. While the Dow dipped lower, artificial intelligence names powered the gains in the S&P 500 and NASDAQ composite indexes. The NASDAQ bobbed around the 16,000 level for most of the week before posting consecutive record highs on Thursday and Friday, surpassing its 2021 record. It was the last of the major three indices benchmarks to reach a record high this year. Economic news also helped boost markets. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, or the PCE, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, rose 0.3% in January versus December and 2.4% on a 12-month basis. Both were in line with expectations. Stocks ticked higher on Thursday following the release of the report. And thanks to Y Charts, if you go out to my website, look at the blog at www.northboundwealth.com, you'll see Y charts on there, weekly market insights, major index return summary. So I like to kind of touch on that and review how things are going. So year to date, Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 4.09%. The MSCI EAFE Index is up 3.25%. The NASDAQ is up 8.55%. The S&P 500 is up 7.97%. The S&P 500 daily closed. It closed at 5,137. The 10-year Treasury notes latest closes at 4.19%. 1 month ago, it was at 3.87. 3 months ago, it was at 4.22. And 1 year ago, it was at 4.01. So it's a little bit up from where it was. The source is Y Charts, March 2nd, 2024, weekly performance measured from Monday, February 26th to Friday, March 1st. On the blog, I've got this ROC5, which is the rate of change of the index of the previous five trading days. And then TR stands for total return for the index, which includes any dividends as well as any other cash distributions during the period. And the Treasury note yield is expressed in basis points. So there you have it. Consumer remains upbeat. While all the excitement over AI, it's easy to overlook some of the key economic indicators that also speak to the underlying strength of the economy, specifically consumer data. In addition to the closely watched PCE report, at the end of the week, consumer survey revealed that while sentiment softened in February, it remained near a 32-month high. Fresh data this week also showed an unexpected jump in personal income. Finally, the PCE report also reflected an ongoing consumer shift from goods to services, a sign that the economy continues to normalize after the pandemic. Since two-thirds of GDP or gross domestic product comes from consumer spending, these consumer-related metrics helped support the narrative that the economy appears to be gathering momentum and actually not slowing down. Let's see. This week, key economic data. Monday, we're tracking motor vehicle sales. Tuesday, factory orders and ISM services index. Wednesday, ADP employment report, JOLTS survey, and the Beige Book, which is fascinating. Just kidding. Thursday, Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell or Jerome Powell, he speaks. There's jobless claims, international trades in goods and services, productivity and costs. All of that data is coming in on Thursday. And then Friday, once again, the employment situation report, we kind of get a reading there. So all of that source data is from Investors Business Daily, the Econoday Economic Calendar through the end of February. And it's a pretty good thing to track if you're wanting to stay up to date on that information. This week, companies reporting earnings. So we're going to be checking out Target on Tuesday, Wednesday, Dollar Tree, Campbell Soup, Thursday, Costco Wholesale, Broadcom, and the Kroger Company. So we'll kind of see how the consumer's doing in those different areas as well. Tax tip of the week. Owe the IRS money? Here's how to pay. So if you owe on federal taxes, you must pay by the April deadline. Remember, if you get an extension to file your taxes, payment is still due by the April deadline. If you can't pay the total amount you owe now, you may be able to set up a payment plan. Here are some of the choices for making your payment. Number one, use direct pay. IRS direct pay is free and secure. It's a great way to pay directly from your checking and savings account. Number two, pay by debit card or credit card. If you don't want to link it to a bank account, you can always use your credit and or debit card. Remember that you'll have to pay a processing fee and you may incur interest charges. And then number three, pay when you file. So if you file your federal return electronically, you can pay directly from your bank account using electronic funds withdrawal. Again, this article and information is for informational purposes only and does not replace real life advice. So consult your tax, legal, and accounting professionals before modifying your tax strategy. And this tip was adapted from IRS.gov. All right, on to the next segment. First quarter earnings. The devil is in the details. On financial websites, you may read, quote, first quarter profits, corporate profits were better than expected, end quote. And that's true. So far, 73% of Standard & Poor's S&P 500 companies have reported actual Q4 earnings per share above estimated earnings per share. But the devil is in the details. In the fourth quarter of 2023, total S&P 500 earnings are projected to increase by almost $35 billion, that's dollars, or 7.4% from a year earlier. But let's pull back the curtain and see what companies contributed the most and the least to that overall total. The top 15 companies are projected to generate $61 billion in earnings, led by Nvidia, which was $10.6 billion, and Amazon, $10.3 billion. On a year-over-year basis, the top 15 will see earnings increase by 78%. The middle 470 are expected to contribute $8.5 billion year-over-year, a 2.6% increase on average. The bottom 15 companies are projected to lose $35 billion, led by Pfizer at negative $6 billion and Citibank at negative $4.2 billion. On a year-over-year basis, the bottom 15's earnings will decline by 46.8%. The hot topic is inflation. There were 254 mentions of that. The term inflation was mentioned at least once during the earnings conference calls. 254 of the S&P 500 companies, according to FactSet research, as of February 29, 2023. The data is covering from December 15th to February 23rd, so last year to this year. What does it all mean? It's a cautionary tale about the dangers of watching headlines. They summarize the key points, but may overlook important details. I work with professionals who spend time on analyzing the S&P 500 earnings reports so I can bring the most up-to-date information to any discussions we have about your investment strategy. Stay tuned for the next segment. So check this out. Here are some important birthdays over the age of 50. If you're over the age of 50, you got to pay attention to this. Most children stop being a half, like an age and a half birthday, somewhere around the age of 12. Kids add the and a half to make sure everyone knows they're closer to their next age than to the last age. When you are older, and a half birthdays are making a comeback. In fact, starting at age 50, several birthdays and half birthdays are critical to understand because they have implications regarding your retirement income. So at age 50, workers in certain qualified retirement plans are able to begin making annual catch-up contributions in addition to their normal contributions. Those who participate in 401k, 403b, and 457 plans can contribute an additional $7,500 a year in 2024. Those who participate in simple individual retirement accounts or simple IRAs or simple 401ks can make a catch-up contribution of up to $3,500 in 2024. And those who participate in traditional or Roth IRAs can set aside an additional $1,000 a year. At 59 and a half, at age 59 and a half, workers are able to start making withdrawals from qualified retirement plans without incurring a 10% federal income tax penalty. This applies to workers who have contributed to IRA and employer-sponsored plans, such as 401k, 403b, 457 plans, and are never subject to the 10% penalty. Keep in mind that distributions from traditional IRAs, 401k plans, and other employer-sponsored retirement plans are taxed as ordinary income. At age 62, guys, at age 62, workers are first able to draw Social Security retirement benefits. However, if a person continues to work, those benefits will be reduced. The Social Security Administration will deduct $1 in benefits for every $2 an individual earns above an annual limit. In 2024, the income limit is $22,320. At age 65, individuals can qualify for Medicare. The Social Security Administration recommends applying 3 months before reaching age 65. It's important to note that if you are already receiving Social Security benefits, you will automatically be enrolled in Medicare Part A, which is hospitalization, and Part B, medical insurance, without an additional application. Age 65 to 67, so that's like an age range more than a specific age, but between the ages of 65 and 67, individuals become eligible to receive 100% of their Social Security benefit. The age varies depending on your birth year. Individuals born in 1955, for example, become eligible to receive 100% of their benefits when they reach the age of 66 years and 2 months. Those born in 1960 or later need to reach the age of 67 before they'll become eligible to receive full benefits. In age 73, in most circumstances, once you reach the age of 73, you must begin taking required minimum distributions from a traditional individual retirement account or another defined contribution plans. You may continue to contribute to traditional IRA past the age of 70 and a half, so long as you meet the earned income requirement. Understanding key birthdays may help you better prepare for certain retirement income and benefits. But perhaps more importantly, knowing key birthdays can help you avoid penalties that may be imposed if you miss a date. So, number one, if you reach the age of 50 before the end of the calendar year. Number two, IRS.gov 2023. So, some of the resources from this article are number one, if you reach the age of 50 before the end of a calendar year. Number two, IRS.gov. Number three, Social Security Administration. So that's SSA.gov and all 2023 data and some of the additional publications that support that. And the content, again, is developed from sources believed to be providing accurate information. The information in this material is not intended as tax or legal advice. It may not be used for the purpose of avoiding any federal tax penalties. Please consult your legal or tax professionals for specific information regarding your individual situation. Hey everyone, this is Brent Foster. I thought I'd share this article by Charles Rothblue, CFA, editor of the AAII Journal, which is the American Association of Individual Investors Journal. I thought that this was relevant given the approval of spot Bitcoin ETFs in January. So his title of this article is Speculative Assets Placed into ETFs Can Still Be Wrecking Balls. So a longstanding advantage of mutual funds and exchange-traded funds or ETFs is the ease of getting exposure to various types of assets and investments. Even individual investors with small amounts of wealth can get exposure to foreign markets, commercial real estate, and diversified bond portfolios with little effort. ETFs are also being increasingly used by advisors for their tax efficiency and ease of providing exposure to various investments. At the same time, some mutual funds and ETFs offer potential for a wrecking ball swinging inside your portfolio. Obviously, if you're not careful, that's my comment. Or this risk also exists with individual securities, be they stocks, bonds, publicly traded partnerships, et cetera. The bigger danger with funds is the potential to perceive them as safer simply because they are in a mutual fund or ETF. A fund comprising high risk investments is a risky fund. The latest example of a risky asset being placed into fund wrapper is Bitcoin. Last month, which this is the February issue, so they're talking about January. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, or the SEC, approved the first ever spot Bitcoin ETF. The 11 ETFs to get the green light are designed to directly track the prevailing market or spot price of Bitcoin. Previous cryptocurrency ETFs provided indirect exposure via trusts or futures. This was not a decision the SEC came to lightly. The agency had increasingly found itself under pressure to approve spot Bitcoin ETFs after denying applications for such funds over the course of many years. In the accelerated approval issued last month, the SEC cited a U.S. Court of Appeals ruling against its prior denial of a grayscale application for a spot Bitcoin ETF among its reasons for changing course. The court opined that the SEC had failed to adequately explain its reasoning for denying grayscale's application. Proponents of Bitcoin ETFs say that the new funds will make it easier for investors to get exposure to Bitcoin and will reduce the chances of fraud occurring. Stricter rules and procedures have been put in place to avoid the vacuum that Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF, and others tried to operate in. Proponents also argue that Bitcoin provides additional diversification benefits to portfolios. Among the opponents' arguments are that Bitcoin is highly speculative. It was created out of thin air in January of 2009 and has experienced a very high level of volatility since the latter half of the 2010s. Putting Bitcoin into an ETF wrapper changes none of this. When a high-risk asset is placed into an ETF or something similar, it remains a high-risk asset. The only things changing about Bitcoin are that it will be easier and cheaper to trade and will be offered through a more regulated structure. This is hardly the first time we've seen high-risk funds created, and it certainly won't be the last. Single stock ETFs were launched in 2022. As the name implies, they provide leveraged exposure to a single stock like Tesla and allow you to speculate on a stock's near-term upside or downside. Various leveraged and inverse ETFs and mutual funds have also been in existence, with some imploding. There is a very long and not very positive history of thematic funds. Those of you who are investing during the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s may remember the Munder Net Fund, net fund. Frankly, I don't remember that one. I was just a kid then. This mutual fund rode the dot-com bubble up and then crashed down along with it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happens in markets. It's crazy. The lesson for investors seeking to use mutual funds or ETFs is to always start with the broad-based investment themes. Funds tracking a well-known stock index and a well-known investment-grade bond index, plus cash equivalents like short-term treasuries, money markets, etc., are the default option. You can modify this allocation by including preferences for value, growth, dividend income, smaller companies, international exposure, and seeking broad-based funds for each type. Only after settling on the right mix of more traditional types of investments should speculative whims be considered. He goes on to talk a little bit more, but I thought it was relevant. I think it's good. I think his risk and his comments are warranted. Start with a broad-based approach, and then like it's a core aspect of your overall wealth strategy. And then there's some exploratory areas or areas that are maybe more speculative in nature that offer some potential upside, but also bring with it more risk. So he's basically saying, don't make an ETF in Bitcoin your core strategy. Make it more of something on the outside. And I do agree with that perspective. And I think it's warranted given the appetite for risk and kind of FOMO going on, fear of missing out on the launching of spot Bitcoin ETFs. I think some of these investments should be part of an overall portfolio strategy, but in very, very small bite-sized pieces that aren't going to implode your entire portfolio if they go south. So anyway, food for thought as you are thinking about your portfolio strategy. And again, if you have any questions about your specific portfolios or your specific strategy, please reach out to me. My name is Brent Foster, Northbound Wealth Podcast, Northbound Wealth Management, and I'd be happy to chat with you. Until next time, have a great week and weekend. We'll talk to you next week. Take care.